with a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
When your daughter's learning how to drive and says,
"Baba, can I drive?"
You say,
"Híjole, here we go."
But what you should say is something that helps protect your ride.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And that's where State Farm comes in, to help you choose the coverage you need, so you can relax until you hear,
"Can we pick up my boyfriend?"
"Wait, what?"
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. State Farm, Bloomington, Illinois.
It's all about the macro productions.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
I am Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
a Swangled.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Rockfin or Rumble or listening, wherever podcasts are served, thanks a million. We appreciate the support. Couldn't do it without you. If you haven't rated the show already, we would appreciate it. If you think we've earned 5 stars, go ahead and give it to us. We're fighting that algorithm battle. The website, macroaggressions.io, is the best place to connect with me. You can also go to activistpost.com and naturalblaze.com to get all the latest news in alternative health and articles from the independent media. Our sponsors helped make this show happen. Thank God for them. We couldn't do it without them. They're amazing. Legal Shield has been in business for half a century in the United States and Canada, and they'll get you an attorney in your area who has, on average, 22 years of experience, and it's only going to cost you about $1 a day. It's the best money you'll ever spend if you're somebody that is without the documents that you need, like a will, a medical directive, a financial power of attorney. Got to have that if you're an adult. It's no fun. Nobody wants to go spend a bunch of money on an attorney to do it, but you got to do it. You get those documents buttoned up, put it in your safe, and you're good to go. If you are a member of Legal Shield, you can do that right away. I'd do it in the first month if I were you. It's going to pay itself off for the next couple of years by doing that. And they'll put a little app on your phone. It's easy as clicking on the app, drop down menu, tell them what you need. I need documents, touch, boom, 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 click a couple buttons, submit, and you'll get a phone call the next day from an attorney in your area who will say, "Hey, let's have you come in and let's take care of all this stuff right now." So I think it's worth checking out. If you're somebody that wants to take a look at this, go to don'tgetpushedaround.com and see what else they've got. If you run a small business, there's a small business component to it. If you carry a gun, they have documentation for that. If you want Identity Shield, there's that as well. There's a lot going on. There's almost too much happening over there. I've been using my Legal Shield recently to deal with a credit collection agency that was coming after my some stupid thing. It was nonsense. I sent it over to the attorneys. They said, we'll take care of it. So that's what you do. That's what rich people do. That's what powerful people do. They have attorneys. They send that stuff over to their attorneys and it's solved immediately. So if you're interested, go to don'tgetpushedaround.com and read more about that. Also, are you struggling with your health? I hope you're not, but sort of the theme of this show has been be proactive. Be proactive in every aspect of your life, especially with your health. I think of it like, if your engine is making a funny noise, you don't want to keep driving it around. You want to have it checked out. So one of the things that I've done is I partnered up with Christian Yordanev. You can go to his livelongerformula.com website and find out. He's going to open up the hood and see what's going on with your engine. He'll give you a organic acids test, and you're going to get like a 15-page PDF that's going to show your levels and all kinds of things, where you're deficient, where you're good, what you need to beef up, what you need to sort of cut back on. That's, if you're somebody that's dealing with digestive problems or your energy is low or, you can't sleep or, you just feel like your hormones are kind of out of whack, this is right in Christian's wheelhouse. This is exactly what he deals with. This is, I would say, his specialty. So if you have brain fog, you wake up, you're just not functioning at your highest level. There might be something going on. There's probably something going on inside your gut too. That's a huge source of a lot of these problems. And you're not going to know what's happening there unless you take one of these tests and find out. And then he will tailor make a performance schedule for you that gets you going. It's 6 months, 12 months, whatever you want to do. It'll be tailor made for you, specific to the issues that your body is facing. I did it when I turned 50. I just did another test with him a couple weeks ago, and the results were pretty alarming. I mean, I'm in good shape. It's fine, but the level of detail is crazy that these tests can get into. So if you're feeling a little bit unwell and you think you want to feel better and you're ready to take control of your health, nobody's coming to save you. You're going to have to do this yourself. Go to livelongerformula.com. Schedule a free consultation with Christian. Tell him I sent you. He'll take care of you and start yourself on the path towards feeling better. Well, now that we got the business out of the way, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Chad Grills from National Capital League. Hey, Chad, how are you? It's good to see you again.
Charlie, it's great to see you again.
You and I've spoken before. We have mutual friends here. I really wanted to talk to you about now that Trump is in. We have watched, I just did an episode a couple weeks ago talking about the death of the mainstream media, and they have nobody to blame but themselves. And some of the stats that I was reading off was, since the election, MSNBC has lost 57% of their audience. That's alarming. CNN.
I love to see it.
I do too. I love to see it too. I love to see Joy Reid out there at the unemployment line trying to get hired. What exactly would you say it is you do here, Joy? All these people have been fired from MSNBC. CNN's numbers are down 50%. You have a background working in the media. What do you make of this whole thing? I mean, I know that these people have it coming to them, but do you think that there's really a change? Like, do you think that the general public in America is finally waking up to the fact that they're being lied to on an industrial scale?
It's the early start of a golden age, and we're still really early. It doesn't mean that the golden age is inevitable, but with what you're seeing in the media and what you're hearing in conversations with your friends, your family, even strangers, right? It all suggests that not only are people, waking up, which probably gets, thrown around too much, but they're starting to pay attention more, ask questions, and start to explore their own freedom of speech a little bit more. And these are all just really positive signs. And I think the evidence of mainstream media continuing to collapse and decline is, it's the major catalyst that we need to get to that golden age.
Yeah, the golden age. I've been dreaming of the mainstream corporate whore media falling on their sword eventually. And it's nice to see Fox News actually seems to be doing quite well. I'm not overly surprised by that, given that they've got Trump in the White House. But they were critical of him during the Biden administration. They weren't necessarily singing his praises. But we now have the rise of the, it seems like there's been a calculation that's been made by those in a position of power. Okay, television news, television narratives, that traditional Operation Mockingbird, kind of dead, kind of hard, you know. Everyone's a bit suspicious. They've been lied, especially if you're on the left, you've been lied to for the last 4 years. You were told that COVID was going to kill you. You were told that Joe Biden is in great physical shape, mental shape, even though he can't find his way off the stage. You were told that Kamala Harris was the best candidate we've maybe ever seen in the history of. I heard a guy on CNN say, he's like, maybe the best candidate we've ever had. And I was like, oh my God. Just astonishing. Lies after lies. And now their audience is waking up, you know, expecting to celebrate after the election. And they go, you weren't just wrong. You were catastrophically wrong. We can't trust you anymore. Where are we going to get our news? And now it's this pivot to the what David Icke has described as the mainstream alternative media. It's like, it's not the television media necessarily, but it's those guys that have gone off, started a podcast, a three-camera podcast that flies people in, totally normal, wink, wink, not CIA, flies people in for these interviews, and all of a sudden, you know, they get a ton of traction. Is that the next sort of battleground for us, is that it's going to leave the traditional mainstream media? We're going to have to be aware of this new mainstream alternative media?
I mean, it's a great question, right? I think anyone that's consuming anything online, you should, you know, take some time and be patient with it while you learn to trust the source and start to maybe cross-reference that source and figure out who are you listening to, what are their incentives. But people are thinking like this now. And with the new mainstream media, or whatever you want to call it, I think what you're seeing is like this decentralization of media, and companies are becoming increasingly smaller. They're able to survive off of many different revenue streams, which makes a business defensible. And so media has typically been this like pejorative amongst investors, where they don't want to touch it, they don't want to invest in it, or if they do, they give a media company much lower revenue multiples to value it. And so a technology company might have revenue multiples of anywhere from, 10 to even 100. Like at Facebook's IPO, it had a revenue multiple of like 100. And meanwhile, a media company has a revenue multiple of like, you know, 1 to 2. Investors will beat you down on that, right? However, if you look at the economics now of this decentralized media, they're different. And no, they might not scale up to IPO or to become a Facebook, but they're very viable businesses. So it's an exciting time. And I mean, the amount of ad spend that still gets put into TV, radio, it's still enormous, right? I think TV is still around like $88 billion a year, radio $17 billion. And then podcasts are this nascent medium of $2.5 billion a year. So it's still really early.
Where are we going with that podcasting number? Because I remember when it was like 500 million, and now it's a couple $1 billion, and it doesn't seem like it's slowing down anytime soon. Where can podcasting go?
It won't. And I think as shows start to combine more mediums, whether that's video, I think soon we're going to be seeing a lot of shows that do video, VR, AR. That'll probably take a while, but as we start to see shows embrace more and more mediums, we're going to see, the rise of decentralized media. There's going to become new incumbents that are, you know, beholden to certain corporate interests. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, right? There are certainly corporations out there that are doing good work. There's ones that are doing nefarious work. But it's going to be a dynamic time.
Yeah. I've had to walk that line with advertisers. I've got to have them, but I've got to have the right ones. You know, I mean, you get the wrong one in here and your credibility goes away. Plus, you know, I mean, I like small businesses. I like to have ideologically aligned people. I like to know the owners or, you know, the management team, and see if these are people I would want to hang out with. If this is, you know, if I you know, because I'm always looking over my shoulder, like, God, you don't want to bring the wrong person, the wrong advertiser in, and next thing you know, they're starting to tap you and go, well, you know, listen, you were critical about this one thing, or we're a medicine company, we need you to, you know, stop talking about how dangerous vaccines are. I was like, what? Wait, what? I'm not going to do that. I'm going to talk about it twice as much now that you don't. So I've had to walk that line of advertisers, and I think a lot of people in the podcasting world, especially in the alternative media, like the independent media sphere, where I would say I am, there's not a lot of advertisers that want to come in and spend money on people that are talking about controversial things. I mean, they have to answer to their shareholders, and it becomes a whole project. So I don't know. I mean, I wonder where it is we go, the smaller guys go, to try and find some of that revenue without compromising yourself, selling yourself out, or, you know, anything like that.
Yeah, I think just doing diligence on the company, right? And like you mentioned, connecting with the C-levels that are running it, connecting with the executives there, that's always a really wise thing to do. And it's not something where, you know, if you go to a company too large, eventually you're going to be stuck working with like the middle level management team, and that managerial class is gradually being eroded, right? Whether they're being fired from government, whether they're being fired and replaced by AI at corporations, which I think some of those fears might be overblown, but the reality is that class of sensors is essentially going away. And in terms of like the investment landscape, so I'm out in a little bit outside of the city in Austin, Texas, and the collection of high net worth individuals, investors that have flocked here to Texas as a reaction to what's going on the coast, it's very promising, right? Because when you have an investor that's committed to freedom of speech backing a company that becomes successful, that becomes a potential advertiser or sponsor, those ethos are going to be transmitted to the company. Now, it's not a perfect translation, but that trend is starting to accelerate. So you start to have these sponsors that they're not fearful, and they actually want you to take some swings and maybe do some investigations or break some, you know, some things you've discovered. And this is a good thing.
Right at the same time, Hollywood is slitting its own throat. The new Snow White will be out pretty soon. Snow White and the Seven People of Varying Heights, you know, and shades of color. Can't say dwarfs. That'll get us in trouble.
No, totally.
The wokeism has been, I mean, I looked at like Disney stock or Comcast. At some point, doesn't the board of directors have to step in and say, you guys are, you've cut $100+ billion of market cap off of these companies just by going woke? Like,
they have no idea what they're doing.
There are no adults in the room for this conversation?
Well, a lot of the adults, they've fired, and there's some lawsuits now from senior executives that are pretty much, there's one that's like brand new, that I'm very familiar with. And you're going to see a lot more of those. People who were wrongfully terminated for bringing good ideas and they just didn't fit a certain, you know, they didn't want to play along with the discrimination, essentially. And they themselves were discriminated against, kicked out wrongfully. And you're going to start seeing a lot of people speak up. And I'm not a litigious person. However, just like you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast with the Shield ad read, you're going to need attorneys. You know, if you're going to step into the arena of business, whether it's Shield AI or what is it? Shield? Legal Shield. Sorry, yeah. I was thinking of the defense company. But so whether it's Legal Shield or whether it's, you know, your own attorneys that you're meeting and building relationships with, you're going to need to understand these things, right? You're going to need to be able to protect yourself. Yeah. And I think we're, you know, just like the media is changing, you're starting to have people who, for years or decades, were actively discriminated against that said, you know, actually, no, I looked into the law and you can't do this. And there's going to be accountability.
That'd be nice, not just in the media, but just throughout, you know, whether you're a teacher that got fired for refusing to take a shot, whether you're some guy who works as a machinist in some company and the OSHA came in and started pushing people around saying, you got to do this, you got to do that. We get some accountability in government, you think, at some point here?
Yes. Yeah. It's, I mean, the early stages of that are coming. But I think it starts at a local level, right? Like the waiting for national change or waiting for your leaders to do something for you is not a good strategy.
Never.
You know, it's okay to be inspired by it, but ultimately, the individual courage required to challenge things at a local level is that's the piece of the equation that's really missing in this like populist revival or whatever you want to call it, right?
Yeah.
However, it's starting to change. And I think for any individuals out there that are listening that might be in a position where they can speak out or, you know, maybe explore a business or a trade expression or a legal action, whatever it is, if you're pursuing accountability by the letter and spirit of the law, these are good things. And being able to impact things at a local level is you have a much greater probability of succeeding in that than you do at the national level, right? So yeah. Getting individuals excited about that is really important.
But we're going to get some removal of regulations from Trump on top of that too at the same time. If we do this correctly, we have states starting to wake up, and then we have Big Daddy Trump out there saying, you know, I've been doing business a long time, and there's it obviously in building high-rise construction, you deal with nothing but regulations. It's the permitting and everything. It's how high of a priority do you think this is for him to, while he's in there, make some headway with cutting regulations for a variety of entire industries, I would say.
I think it's going to happen. It might be slow at first, but I think he can set enough of a foundation where the next president can take the ball and get it across the finish line, like even if we're not able to get quite there. But as Doge starts to get closer to more corruption, I think that's where you're going to see, as they start to report on that, you're going to see the public start to get, you know, support. They're going to start talking about, why do we need this government agency? There's something like 457 government agencies now, or probably more than that. And it is a real question of like, why do we need them? And the whole like USAID thing, as that continues to like get into the public consciousness, I think people are going to start thinking more about their own local city. Because, you know, speaking as someone who's living in Austin, you have a city that has an annual budget of like $5.9 billion. If you look at other cities in Texas, some of them have, you know, a budget that's like way less, way more people. So you have this like inflated budget, you know, a huge amount of money gets spent each year. Austin only has like 1.1 million people in it or something. And you have a network of about 15,000 nonprofits here. So the same problem that we have at a national level is a lot of these big left-leaning Democrat-controlled cities, it's the same thing. It's the same thing except on a smaller scale. And as that starts to be dismantled, you're going to be able to, I think, get the public support for large-scale structural reforms.
Let's talk about capital allocation then. On the government level, because this is where is it flowing? Where if you've got the money, you know, we've watched Doge say, well, here's where it shouldn't be going, but where should it be rerouted to?
So this is a great question, and obviously causes a lot of people to bristle, because when the second you start thinking about government spending or allocating money, people can fall into the trap of thinking like, oh, it's a communist thing, or it needs to be more of a capitalist thing, or it's crony capitalism, whatever. The point is that there's capital being allocated. It's going to be spent, it's going to be used, or it's going to be saved in some form or fashion. And I first got interested in this topic. I was doing a self-directed study in economics. I was studying under Dr. Chambers, who's now on the Council of Economic Advisors, brilliant economist. And I was just studying, it was Obama's stimulus plan. That was what the whole, you know, self-directed study that I've created was, to essentially just follow the money, right? And the answer is it gets allocated to many different nonprofits, and the nonprofit in turn pays the person that's ideologically aligned an overinflated salary, and they don't do much, if anything. And then they dole out that money to their friends that are activists, that are all about communism. They're about taking people's rights away. And so, you know, whenever you're in doubt, just follow the money and you can kind of learn what's happening. But that's been the status quo for national capital allocation for quite some time, which is it goes to the government, then it goes to nonprofits, and then it goes to Democrats.
And then they do nothing with it except squander it.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So if you're, so now the Democrats are out. We've got a Republican in there. We've heard about opening up Anwar in Alaska for energy, for more drilling. We've heard about opening up the renewing oil lease, you know, offshore oil leases in the Gulf of America now. Where would you allocate capital? How would you allocate it differently under, you know, if it's not, obviously can't go to these nonprofits, these NGOs that are squandering it, but that's really relatively, I mean, that's been going on since, you know, the 70s. We've been seeing that for a long time. So it's nothing entirely new, but I think we've had a look inside recently and people are going, wait, we knew that there was a lot, there was government waste and we knew it was pretty bad, but we didn't realize it was to this extent. I think the general public is kind of opening their eyes to it. They know that there's a ton of money flowing into the government. It's got to go somewhere. You got 4 years to allocate it differently. How would we do that this time around?
Great question. I think just starting with the minimal functions that you're going to need to operate government at a balanced budget level, I think that's a wise place to start. DOGE is approaching, you know, their target, I think, is $2 trillion of cuts to get the budget back to a balanced position. They're at about $200 billion of cuts right now. That's exciting. The first place with any surplus, I think, is just like an individual needs a savings account, a country needs a sovereign wealth fund. The countries that are the most successful over time, they have sovereign wealth funds. The U.S. states that are most successful, they have their own sovereign wealth funds, like Texas. Texas has two. Alaska has one. And that's the starting place, right? And before you start thinking about spending the money and allocating it, a big part of successful capital allocation is not doing anything. And this is very hard. This is almost impossible. And to the extent that you can hold off and just prove as a nation your ability to keep money in your savings, I think that's incredibly important. You know, we see what's going on with Social Security and things like that, where it's very hard for the government to not allocate the money somewhere. But to get to a place where you're allocating capital very successfully, you first have to prove that you can just keep it. So, you know, minimizing extra expenditures, balancing the budget, and then starting that sovereign wealth fund, I think that's going to be the key thing there. And, you know, when it comes to the biggest line item in the budget, of course, is defense. And again, people have a lot of strong opinions about this. But one of the really positive signs that we see in the defense industry is they're scaling back the budget, and they're also starting to explore things like investing into investors, and so matching limited partner contributions into certain investment funds. And again, people are going to think crony capitalism, maybe rightly so. You know, it's not clear that this is going to be successful. But if we look at where our technology, a lot of our comforts of modern life came from, for better or worse, they were through DoD investment. Silicon Valley was essentially, you know, started with a lot of DoD technology research investment. And, you know, what we're using right now, the internet, started as ARPANET. It doesn't mean that everything needs to be linked to defense, but it does mean that maybe allocating in that fashion could be good in the long term for everyone. And it obviously, a lot of challenges there. We're still in the early days of this, but those are just some initial thoughts.
I used to always think that the sovereign wealth funds of especially the Middle Eastern nations, like the Saudis Public Investment Fund or the Qataris fund, was just to diversify out of oil and gas, and it probably was.
Sure.
If you're America and you start a sovereign wealth fund, what do you pack it with? Do you buy companies? And because there was talk about, well, we'll just buy TikTok and put it in there. There's a Bitcoin strategic reserve. There's a sovereign wealth component to it. You mentioned you're in Texas. Texas is talking about a Bitcoin strategic reserve there as well. What would you do if someone appointed you to be in charge of this sovereign wealth fund? Where would you be looking to, what would you be acquiring?
Good question. I don't know if acquiring is the right answer, but I do think that allocating to top American And I would go as far as saying pro-American managers who have a demonstrated track record. I would think that allocating to those funds is a good place to start. It's going to provoke an intense public backlash. But if you're the beauty of a lot of these fund managers, pensions, institutions, venture capitalists, is that they have to keep meticulous books. They have to keep meticulous proof of the results that they're creating. And obviously, you're going to have something like FTX occasionally, but that's not really an example of a pro-American investor who is keeping meticulous books and has a CFO and everything like that. And I think what's interesting about that allocation strategy is you can, over time, make it so it is more fair. Like, is that strategy going to be fair to the emerging manager that doesn't yet have an established track record? Maybe not. But is that manager who's consistently beating the S&P 500 going to be able to identify the early stage startups, the technologies? Are they going to be able to allocate better than the government would be? Or do we want to create a situation where all of these governments are owning big companies? And the idea of the U.S. owning TikTok is just really bad on a number of levels. But so that's really the first approach, would be letting the people who have risen in the arena start to manage and allocate that capital. And the fees that they're generating and everything can be public knowledge. And I think you can start to create a more fair financial system, because the idea that we have capitalism or a free market now is just laughably absurd.
Yeah.
There's a great book called The Myth of Capitalism that shows like the consolidation of companies in every industry. And we're so far away from a free market that in order to get there, it might require the government just making better capital allocation decisions.
Would this sovereign wealth fund be the vehicle used for the reindustrialization of America?
I think so. And I think this is the biggest popular trend that I'm not skeptical of. So a lot of folks might be familiar with reindustrialization and the concept. But if we look back at when America first started to industrialize around 1849 or so, it went from a relatively small economy to the largest in the world in about 40 years after we started industrializing. And now we have reindustrialization happening where we're starting to realize, okay, we need to be able to build our own technologies. We need to have manufacturing. And really, we need high-paying jobs for people that are safe and at least safer than the first wave of industrialization. And I think with this second wave here, you know, you already have overregulation with safety. So safety isn't really as much a concern as that we need high-paying jobs and we need to be able as a country to be self-sufficient.
Get rid of that NAFTA, everything, you know, send all the factories overseas. I think we lost 50,000 factories during that era. Gutted the Rust Belt. I mean, a stain on America. But I think some bankers inside the Clinton administration, probably even earlier than that, Bush, Reagan, made some calculation that it's like, well, you know, it's time to move to China. It's time to turn that into the factory of the world. But that doesn't necessarily have to be the case moving forward, right? We can do that here. If we were inspired to do so, or incentivized, or the regulations went away, is part of this just regulations and laws and things like this that is forcing companies to say, listen, it's just it's nothing personal, man. It's just math. I'm just looking at the numbers, and we can't build our widgets here for what we need in order to sell it. So we have to send it to Thailand, or we have to send it to Mexico. And if only we could do it differently, we would love to build it here, but we just can't. Is that how we tackle this?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think it's so hard for businesses to generate any profit and ever satisfy shareholders, investors, and the end users of their products in the current market that we have, where there are so many monopolies, that the places with the best incentives are going to win. And they're not just going to win by a little bit. If you think about why Elon chose Texas, I think the primary reason was he was scouting both in California and New York to build new factories, whether it was Starlink or Gigafactory. And he was getting quotes of it's going to take 10 to 12 years to build your factory. And even then, we can't promise that. And he got on the phone with folks in Texas, and they were able to promise and deliver on a 6 to 18 month build time, all regulations factored in, all approvals. And again, it's like, not saying that, you know, everything and, you know, every situation like that needs to be decided by the government, but ultimately, you know, the government is the arbiter. And if you have ease of a building and getting to market, and if you can give a CEO or allocator of capital predictability, they're going to take it. And so, I mean, Texas has set a huge precedent with that. And the flood of businesses to the state has been, I mean, it's going through a boom right now, but I think people just have no idea what the future of the Texas economy is going to be. It's going to be big.
Well, yeah, if you're running a company and you're in the Biden administration is in charge, and they're, you know, they're sending in OSHA to make your people wear masks or stand 6 feet apart, or they're reimagining your restaurant, and they're saying, well, you can't have your restaurant operating inside the restaurant. You have to move it outside, and then you have to put a tarp over it. Then you have to put heaters out there, and you have to build your restaurant, your indoor restaurant, outside. And you go, oh my God, you know, how long is this going to go on for? Trump comes in, like him or not, he gives a little bit more certainty to these, you know, the decision makers at these companies, where they're trying to, like, I got to plan years in advance. I need to know if I'm going to expand. I need to know if I need to hire. I need to know all these things. And with the Biden administration, everything was very murky. And with Trump, it at least at the very minimum, it feels like from the business standpoint, things are a little bit more optimistic in the future. Do you get that feeling from him so far?
Totally. Yeah, more predictability is going to lead to more opportunity for everyone involved. And providing that predictability, certainty, it's really important for a leader to do at any level. So it's great to see.
Yeah. I wonder if we've had a bit of a brain drain. I mean, the education system here has been a catastrophe, at least in the government schools. Do we have the intellectual horsepower to pivot to a technological society to really sort of make that a priority? You mentioned Silicon Valley. We've obviously got that. And we've got all the VC money on Sand Hill Road that flows in there. And we, you know, there's a lot happening there. Is that enough? Can we make it as a technological sort of country, or do we have to just continue to be consumers?
Not if Silicon Valley is leading that. If Silicon Valley is leading the creation of our technology, it's not going to go anywhere. We're not going to be successful against China. We're not even going to be successful. We're not going to be successful for very long. California and Silicon Valley are, in a lot of ways, I mean, the popular view is that they're like the creators of everything. They're the geniuses. They're just so much smarter than everyone else. And, you know, having spent 6 years in Silicon Valley and, you know, this is now my second venture-backed company. I raised top-tier venture the first time. Silicon Valley doesn't have much to offer America. They think they do, and they're certain that they do. But if you look at the results of the most successful products that they create, it's questionable, right? Like, does anybody think that Meta's good for children?
No.
Like, does anybody think that Google's doing great things for the world, or that Apple is? Like, you know, it took the president and many other people putting pressure on Apple to actually build here, not store the iPhone private keys in China or whatever was going on there. We need a lot of ecosystems that were like Silicon Valley in the early days. And you started to see those pop up. But I think it's going to be important in the future for every American city to start thinking about, how are we creating things? How are we getting small businesses, startups, inventors funded? How are we being patrons to them? And how do we decentralize the creation of new technologies? But if we're waiting on Silicon Valley to produce anything or save us, we're going to be in trouble.
I fear their head start on artificial intelligence so far. It's hard for me to tell how much of it is just buzz and how much of it is reality. And if the reality of AI is that you can use ChatGPT to help you research things or write up an article or whatever, I mean, then okay, fine. That seems like it's just the evolution of simplifying things. But if we're at a point where, I don't know, Sam Altman and Larry Ellison are in charge of the artificial intelligence and Trump gives them $500 billion to play with, man, I get a bit nervous when those guys are in charge. What's the future of AI for the United States?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would be terrified of that as well. It's like in the announcement, it's like you got Scam Altman out there and then you got Larry grabbing the mic to talk about mRNA, new technologies.
Great. Just like, wonderful.
No, this is not what anybody wants. Who are you talking to? Yeah. And then Masa doesn't understand anyway. So,
right. It's fine. He's just taking his money out into the parking lot, lighting it on fire.
Yeah, totally. And he just backed a $130 billion? I don't know, into a robot solar company or something like that. What could possibly go wrong? And no, Grok's way better than OpenAI, and I'm not going to win any friends by saying that. A lot of the most powerful people in the world have huge stakes in OpenAI now. And anytime you speak out against that, you're not going to win any friends. However, I think the exciting thing about kind of like the revolution that we're going through from a technological and cultural standpoint is that there are going to be many winners. And Silicon Valley is so accustomed to winner-take-all dynamics. A lot of the investors there believe in that. They believe that you have to become a monopoly. You have to succeed at whatever cost. They're only looking for people that will do whatever it takes. And that's not really the way to create like dynastical businesses or really long-term successes. So I think we're going to see OpenAI and some others kind of like fade into irrelevance. And I think Grok is going to become, I think it already is dominant. And I think there's going to be many other winners, though, in like vertical specific AI. So companies that are developing, maybe even leveraging Grok for highly specific tasks with their own hardware, software. I don't think it has to be this dystopia hellscape. And I think there's going to be ultimately a lot of winners.
Well, we do have a really transformative technology called blockchain that seems to be extremely important out there. We've got, it's not limited to Bitcoin, though it kind of got its start with Bitcoin. And I come out of real estate, and I always wondered, why does it take so long? Like when you're closing, you're selling a house, buying or selling a house, you get to the closing table. Why does it take so long? Like, well, we have to have our docs and we have to have it verified. And we have to do this and this. And God, man, you'll get your keys in 3 days. We'll tell you when everything is closed. It seems like we've got some real opportunities to take some of these antiquated systems, especially the ones I saw in real estate, move them onto the blockchain and have a little bit more of a permanent record and some real opportunities for businesses. Do you see that as well?
100%. And we're still in the early days of blockchain and cryptography. And I think getting back to the origins of cryptography is important. It was a technology that's created around being able to prove something and transmit something securely. It's ultimately, a technology that aligns with freedom of speech and freedom of association. So if you look at AI on one end of the spectrum, AI is increasingly going to be used for things like surveillance. And then cryptography, however, is going to be used for things like freedom of speech and freedom of association, being able to prove that something happened. And so while there's been a lot of froth in the crypto market as a whole, if you start to drill down to some of the technologies, that's where it gets really exciting. There's a company up in Tyler, Texas, by a group of really fascinating math guys, and they're working on zero knowledge proofs. They're not the only company that's working on zero knowledge. However, that's a great example of a technology that is, it doesn't have the potential to like transform things a little bit. It has the potential to make your life better. And I think for so long, crypto hasn't had a good argument about how is this going to help make your life better. And so what zero knowledge proofs do, they essentially allow you to, I can show to you that I either have something, know something, or have done something. And without showing you how I did it, the technology proves that I am in fact telling the truth. So if you think about how would that work at scale when businesses can interact or in finance or just when two people are, approaching an investment or a business deal or anything like that, zero knowledge proofs is a great example of like how cryptography is evolving to a place where it could make your life better.
Interested. You come out of the military, right? You got a military background. I'm always fascinated. There's an interesting group of people that come out of the military with an entrepreneurial mindset. What were some of the lessons you learned in the military that actually do translate into the civilian world?
Sure. So I've always been interested in business, and when I graduated high school, I wanted to start. The end goal was to have my own business, and I ended up going into the military. That was also just another aspiration of mine. It was I think males especially are going to look for and eventually find a proving ritual. Whether you're conscious of it or not, you're going to need some type of, you're going to create it in your own life or, you know, go to the military. But entering the military as someone who was more entrepreneurial in terms of like looking how to do better, be better, help everyone out. It was interesting because the military is really great in so many different ways. But also in many ways, they're kind of like the antithesis of entrepreneurship. And being too entrepreneurial in any government system puts a target on your back.
Yeah.
And so it was a good balancing act. And yeah, it was a fascinating experience. Ended up going on 2 deployments abroad, 1 to Iraq, 1 to Egypt. Got to do security for a presidential inauguration here at home. So yeah, learned a lot. And
how was Egypt? I had a chance to go to Egypt when I was 16, and it was just one of those things I wanted to, you know, such a unbelievable place. What was your experience there?
Yeah, what part were you in?
I was in Cairo.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I traveled through Cairo when I was traveling home on leave, but the majority of the deployment was Sharm el-Sheikh. So since 1971, the U.S. has kept a battalion of U.S. infantry soldiers in Egypt to help respect the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. And so it's called the MFO mission, but we essentially have a lot of different outposts in the Sinai, and you rotate through these, and there's a base in Sharm el-Sheikh, which is like a very popular European tourist town.
It's like a beach town, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
The base is on the Red Sea. It's gorgeous. And when you're next to the Red Sea, when you start to go into Egypt and the cities, it's not, you know, you wouldn't use the word gorgeous. But yeah, it was right after Mubarak was ousted. And there was quite a bit of chaos and turmoil in the country. Traveling home for leave, I was in the cab and there were some, you know, protests going on in Cairo and everything. I was just thinking like, this is the stupidest thing in the world that they're making us travel alone on leave, like no weapon. It's just really bad idea. But yeah, overall, it was just, I signed up with the intent of deploying and wanting to have that experience, serve my country, and I got to do it.
Yeah, that's cool.
Is that where you got the slow is smooth, smooth is fast? Did that come out of the military?
It did. Yeah, the military's got many sayings, and the whole slow is smooth, smooth is fast is a mantra that gets repeated. And it's good. I find myself reflecting on it from time to time, especially in business where there's that tendency to, you know, do instead of just taking a step back and being patient. So it's something I reflect on from time to time.
I wonder about this for the military and really non-military too. The idea of us getting replaced, you know, the soldiers getting replaced by robots, or the pilots getting replaced by drones, or the humans getting replaced by AI. Like, Americans in America, are we psychologically ready to be replaced by robots? And what does that do to this whole, let's keep it in the military for now. Like, is the military ready to be replaced by robots? Because I've seen all the Terminators. I know what happens. You know, eventually the Sam Altmans of the world create these automated robots, and then case can be made. Well, we don't need to send our people out there to die. We could send this, you know, T-9000 out there to do it for them. I mean, Is the military looking at that stuff right now in a real way?
Sure. And just one caveat, I don't know if Sam has nefarious motives. I think oftentimes people that get enormous success, that are enormously successful from a financial standpoint, are thrust into these like impossible positions. Mm-hmm. So I certainly want to, you know, point that out. And any type of power like that is very, very difficult to wield and, you know, be effective with. So, but yeah, if I think about the whole robots question, I think that in many ways, a lot of the robotics and humanoids things, they're not really something to fear as much as it's a dependable helper. And I think you're starting to see that now with Grok and other things where people are terrified of it. But what is the reality? Like, the reality is you have a very effective research assistant now, and that's kind of nice. Could it get to a Dune-like place where, you know, or Terminator-like place? Maybe, but not if humans continue to create it and put different things in place where, you know, we're becoming better ourselves, we're becoming better people. Ultimately, I think all of these technologies are just a reflection of ourselves, and any technology can be dual use. It can be used for good, it can be used for bad. So the extent to which we improve our own selves is going to be the extent to which these technologies are either used for war or to defend, protect, enrich our own lives.
Yeah, I've got no problem with using AI or you know, some sort of version of that to help automate my tasks a little bit more. I know I've talked to one of the guys I do a podcast with, who's in cybersecurity, says, oh, I use it all the time. I help it. I'll ask it to write me a code for this or that or some sort of thing. And it'll write a code. He'll say, I like some of that code, or I like the whole code, and I'll use it. So he uses it to sort of supplement or augment his job in a reasonable way. I worry about the direction of universal basic income. Hey, you guys are going to be replaced by robots. You in California, you're pushing for a $20 minimum wage at McDonald's. Well, you know, some guy is looking at a spreadsheet, making a calculation. He's going, man, at $18 an hour, we go to robots, you know, and you guys pushed to 20 and now we're at robots. So get out. So like, I wonder where that line is between we're here to help you, and then it's like you're being replaced because the robot doesn't complain about its schedule. The robot never misses the bus. The robot doesn't have drama, show up high, you know, all the things. And you know, and you can depend on it. And we're seeing already going to touchscreens at Wendy's and things like that. I've heard Wendy's tease a concept. I'm not trying to pick on the fast food industry, but it just is one of these things. Talking about dynamic pricing at Wendy's, it's like, well, if you go at 12 o'clock, your double cheeseburger is going to be $10. But if you go at 3 o'clock, then it'll be $7 because there's less traffic. I mean, is that kind of the direction we're going with this technology?
I mean, it's an important question to consider, and I think to the extent that anyone that's coming up in the world of work is alone, they're going to be boxed out and they're going to be replaced very quickly. And I think that the challenge for all of us is, you know, you're going to need to find the others. You're going to need to find the other people who are your friends. You're going to need to have your family. You're going to need to not necessarily join like a labor union, right? But there's going to need to be groups that can negotiate, and you're going to have to figure out how to negotiate. And I think that is the biggest challenge that I don't think anyone has figured out, and UBI is not going to solve it. And it's ultimately on the shoulders of the education system. I think there is a lot that maybe the government could remove, like the Department of Education, to set the stage for all of the pop-up schools and training facilities that are going to be able to help train individuals so they can collaborate together and then negotiate in order to get you know, a living wage. Or I can't believe I'm saying living wage. It sounds pretty like AOC flared. But a better education and more freedom of choice. The more that we can have freedom of choice, the more that we're going to get back or closer to a free market. And I think, you know, with a proliferation of small schools and new training options, I'm really hopeful about that. You know, I have a couple of friends that are in that space, and the demand for the welding, the nursing jobs, the things that are going to take much longer to replace by robots, they're starting to go up. And those are also the fields where we have the biggest shortage.
That's good. We need that. And there's been a demonization of trades over the last, you know, decades or so. And you know, you can laugh at that plumber all you want, man, but that guy goes on nice vacations when he needs to. There's demand for that, and there's certain things that that are always going to be needed. You're somebody who's started companies, raised money. What excites you? What are you working on nowadays? Where are you investing your time and energy and resources?
Yeah, building National Capital League, and we're essentially in stealth, but I'm building the product and network that I want. And when it comes to making money or raising money in a way that's aligned with your values, it's actually really tricky. It's really hard to figure out, in a lot of sense, like, who are you working for? Like, if you take investor money, many investors, they have their own limited partners, and it's tough to know, like, who are you helping make more money? And I think as an entrepreneur that's gone through, you know, building several companies, getting to a couple million in revenue, $1 million free cash flow, and, you know, preparing to do that again and starting to approach that, what's interesting is there's this asymmetry of information. And so whether you're an ambitious young person, whether you're a first-time entrepreneur, whether you're an accredited investor, it's very hard for you to get the same information that the largest money sources and corporations in the world have. And that disparity creates this market where you have a lot of unnecessary distortions. So I see just a huge opportunity here to help people make more money or raise more money in a way that's aligned with their values. And it's still early stages, but starting to get a lot of momentum. And the unique thing about Austin is so many people who have been through something similar are here. And so it's, I'll keep you updated when we launch. But
okay. And the people that are in Austin now, have they relocated from elsewhere to be in a place that's? I mean, Austin always had a real tech hub with Dell being there, and it's sort of built around that, sort of like a Silicon Valley of the South. But are you finding that the people are coming from other countries, coming from other areas of the country itself, or are they homegrown Austin talent?
So a lot of, you know, obviously the majority, they've been in Austin for some time or they're lifelong Texans, but when it comes to transplants and people coming from other states, they're coming here for freedom. And you can have a bunch of other reasons around that, but there is more freedom in Texas. And as a lot of people that are in the government of Texas say, Texas is wide open for business. And if you go down the list of all of the different Texasisms or Texas talk and lingo that the state has, it is truly a unique culture where it's okay to be entrepreneurial. Of course, you have freedom of speech. Of course, you're able to conceal carry. Of course, you're able to defend yourself. And it's not perfect. You know, there's this recent stat from the Attorney General about 70% of the Texas populace living under a Soros-backed DA. That is highly concerning, and there are these challenges, but there is also just this opportunity that is that's massive. And Texas has the Texas Stock Exchange opening up in 2026. New York Stock Exchange Texas is opening up here. NASDAQ is upping their involvement. And anytime you see these big incumbent players moving to an area or setting up exchanges, it's just a signal that the early stage private market is about to take off.
Is Texas state going to follow through on the Bitcoin reserve? Do you know?
I think they did. I think they did. That was passed, and I think that they will. And I think, you know, the U.S. is exploring a sovereign wealth fund for energy, or some type of energy sovereign wealth fund. It's not really clear where that's at yet, but I think that Texas might follow suit or do something similar. Their energy industry is booming here. So yeah, when you start thinking about, okay, we've got this, we've got two sovereign wealth funds, the Texas Permanent School Fund and the Texas Permanent University Fund. That's interesting. A lot of dry powder. You have these exchanges opening up. And there's also about 138 pensions in Texas that collectively manage and allocate over $1 trillion. Not sure exactly what the number is, but one of the things that they've done recently, one of the largest pensions here divested about $8.5 billion from BlackRock. So really? That is a very strong signal. And not only did they do that, but the governor followed suit and ordered that any state entity that had any investments in CCP-linked companies divest them immediately. So not only is the state starting to take measures like that to invest in their own people and put Texans first, but they're actually, you know, putting their money where their mouth is. And it's going to be a really dynamic time.
Chevron relocating from the Bay Area to Houston after forever. I don't know, 100. I mean, that's where they started. That should have been an indicator. You know, on more of a comical level, Joe Rogan relocating from Hollywood, that signaled a pivot from away from woke Hollywood and into sort of a more freedom approach. You see a bunch of, I haven't been in the mothership, but I've walked right by it there and on Sixth Street. So culture moving to Austin too, besides just business. Wow, what an exciting time for Austin.
Totally. And whatever your stance is on comedians, everybody has their own taste. It was a couple hundred comedians followed Rogan here, right? And
yeah, a lot
bought
of people.
Homes, moved here full time. And comedy in so many different ways is that last bastion of free speech where, of course, it's not perfect, but these are the folks that are really pushing back in many ways. It's not an answer to all of our problems, but just being able to articulate what's happening in an honest fashion is incredibly important. And so that community is thriving here. A bunch of other comic clubs have popped up. These are good signs.
That's great. Let's wrap up with this. I'm a disclosure purist. I want disclosure from Epstein to aliens. I want it all. You think we're going to get any real disclosure?
This is a great question. I think it's already starting. I think we've been in that process. And as the American public starts to demand it more and more, we're going to get more and more of it. I think it's going to be proportional and it's going to happen at the same speed at which a majority of people and leaders want it. So I think it's starting. I think it might be painfully slow. I know a lot of folks are frustrated with the Luna and the Bondi and, you know, why isn't Cash arrested everybody yet?
Yeah.
But I think patience is key here. And I think we're in the early stages of disclosure really ramping up.
Oh, I hope so.
That would make me so happy. And I'm impatient with that stuff. I want disclosure yesterday. I want it to come from the right people. And I'm very suspicious of all of it. But ultimately, I think we're ready. We're ready for a little bit more truth. God knows we've been lied to long enough by enough people. I feel optimistic about things. Maybe I shouldn't. Maybe, I don't know, but I do. I feel like there's a re-energized country, you know, obviously there's a segment that's, you know, crying themselves to sleep every night, and that's fine. I don't worry about them, but for the business side of things, for America Incorporated, it feels like we're trending in the right direction. There's a lot more optimism, and we'll see how things go. What's the best place for people to go to connect with you, to follow you, to get more information about the projects that you're working on?
Sure. Chad J. Grills on X and nationalcapitalleague.com.
That's Chad Grills, everybody. Connect
with
him.
Thanks, Charlie.
Follow his outstanding work. We're going to be, We'll keep in touch over the years and we'll see how things go. I'm excited for this. I'm optimistic. If you want to connect with me, you can go to my website, macroaggressions.io, and find out about the books and the podcasts and Activist Post and Natural Blaze and all that good stuff. If you want to follow me on X at macroaggressions, where I argue with robots and get followed by porn bots who suppress my reach, but that's okay because Daddy Elon is coming to fix it all one of these days. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you again soon.